In a way, much to your point earlier, when I heard you guys talking about how people define country music and how it's this is not country music and that's not country music, I think what the root stem of that really is, and again, I wouldn't dare speak for anybody outside of my genre, much less anybody, period, but I would imagine that there's something where you're trying to hold on to that way of life that really resonated with you. And doing it while being subjected to the sands of time and progress. And it's a very dissident and uncomfortable feeling when you feel like the heart and the soul of something like in American Graffiti tends to wane as the years progress, and the struggle to hold on to that, but then also finding it again in music. And I think that that is, in a way, why that movie was so impactful, was because it really unified the visual and audio in a harmonious manner that allowed the soundtrack to tell the story and the story to be the visual to what you would imagine the soundtrack to be of that time, of that era, the cars in and I mean, in some ways, you know, it makes you miss a time that you never experienced.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Set Lessing Bruce, your podcast all about Bruce Springsteen, his music, and mostly his fans. I am your host, Jesse Jackson. We are getting off the Bruce train today, but he will be coming up. And I'm talking to a fellow podcaster and someone who we've already had a great conversation talking about music and themes. And Drake, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me this evening.
Yeah, tell me a little about yourself.
Well, the origins of my musical background stem predominantly in the classical realm, also metal, symphonic, musical theater, and a lot of the themes that also tied in with what you were talking about in your previous conversation in terms of the theatrics and using powerful stage shows to kind of represent and tell messages. I'm a very big advocate of that in what I try to do live as well, sharing stories and building, as you spoke about, musical legacies, through live and through music. And then the overarching theme of being able to take the same emotions that you feel within your genre and being able to portray them in the various aspects of, musical theater, classical music, metal. I think there's a lot of overarching that can be, that can be seen that coincide no matter regardless of the artist or the genre of the music. There's always those songs that will genuinely speak to an individual and change them.
Yeah, music means so much to so many people. I say this slightly tongue in cheek when I ask someone who's their favorite musician or their favorite genre, and like, oh, I just kind of like everything. I'm like, okay, but don't you have something you especially love? So, yeah, I always like to go to the beginning. So, talk about where did you grow up? And what kind of music did your family listen to when you were a youngster?
I actually grew up in a relatively small town, although I had family that also lived in Chicago proper. And there was a lot of back and forth between that. And I feel that between that, I got a good upbringing, both in nature and in country, but then also in the urban environment. And I was able to appreciate both, respectively. In terms of the music, it was very diverse and actually very antithetical to how I ended up going. where most of my family was into, you know, pop and country and musicals even. And I think that, I mean, I did draw from the musical. My brother was very much into classical music and was a very accomplished guitarist. My father really didn't have a musical bone in his body, although he was a huge proponent of the oldies. He could absolutely be identified as such. And as a matter of fact, has a record collection that I currently possess that would rival most stores. His entire legacy was record collecting and trading. And to put it approximately, I think we have about, God, I don't even know, I would imagine 15,000 records as of right now. It is ridiculous. And so through that, I really did get an eclectic kind of upbringing in music. My favorite defining moment where music and visuals came was through the film American Graffiti. And even though my mom at the time would try to prevent me from seeing it, you know, due to all the adult themes, you know, it was my father who actually kind of snuck that one under the radar. And so, yeah, very eclectic. After that, I then found classical music via Beethoven. And it was actually Beethoven and specifically Moonlight Sonata that changed my life and was the catalyst of myself going into the musical realm. So
what, tell me how, okay, before I get to that, I got to get back to American Graffiti.
Sure.
You know, one of the things I just finished reading, Ron Howard, and Clint Howard did a book together about them growing up, and Ron talked about being cast in American Graffiti, and George saying, you know, he went to George, he says, look, I can't sing, you say it's a musical, and despite what, you know, this isn't, he goes, no, it's not that kind of musical. And it was in many ways, right, the first soundtrack that we that became, you know, that as a movie soundtrack. I adored that movie. I adored everything about it, and all the music. And I was thinking today when Beach Boys All Summer Long came on, you know, because that's how they ended with that. Tell me a little bit more about American Graffiti.
Oh, I saw the documentary and I didn't appreciate cinematography until I did. The way that they had to accomplish the lighting within the vehicles and being able to tell the story just through that alone, and the struggles that they went through in order just to make that alone happen. And then the constant back and forth with the soundtrack, as you said, that in of itself, plus in a way, much to your point earlier, when I heard you guys talking about how people define country music and how it's, this is not country music and that's not country music, I think what the root stem of that really is, and again, I wouldn't dare speak for anybody outside of my genre, much less anybody, period, but I would imagine that there's something where you're trying to hold on to that way of life that really resonated with you, and doing it while being subjected to the sands of time and progress. And it's a very dissident and uncomfortable feeling when you feel like the heart and the soul of something like in American Graffiti tends to wane as the years progress, and the struggle to hold on to that, but then also finding it again in music. And I think that that is, in a way, why that movie was so impactful, was because it really unified the visual and audio in a harmonious manner that allowed the soundtrack to tell the story and the story to be the visual to what you would imagine the soundtrack to be of that time, of that era, the cars, you know, and I mean, in some ways, you know, it makes you miss a time that you never experienced.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
You know, I kind of the same way that I'm before I was obsessed with Bruce Springsteen, I was obsessed with Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys. And Brian was selling California that didn't exist, right? There's two girls for every boy. They're, you know, they're Sun and Surf. And you go, and I remember someone reading that there's no doubt that Madison Avenue was using Beach Boy songs to sell stuff because Brian was selling California to all of us then. I totally agree. I want to go back. You mentioned classical music spoke to you. Tell me a little bit more about that, and what kind of did you learn an instrument just as a fan? Talk to me about classical music speaking to you.
Prior to the age of 17, I was outside of the aforementioned American Graffiti and the brushes with music. I myself wasn't very much even into music. I was a manual artist, a drawer, and a painter, and did all of that. And throughout the years, I found a increasing dissatisfaction because what I was feeling, regardless of the circumstances, a lack of talent or understanding, I couldn't convey that in just the visual medium alone. And I became very despondent of that. And that was really before even discovering Beethoven. I had jokingly said on a previous interview where, you know, it also makes you really appreciate the accessibility we have to just go look up music that we have today. Back when I was in high school, I was suffering kind of a lot of personal tragedies. I think a lot of personal tragedies that we all could relate to. And I had passed by the musical class when they were going over musical history, and on a CD, on a radio, they played Moonlight Sonata, and it stopped me in my tracks. I never made it to the following class, and much less did I make it to the following class days after, because I repeatedly would seek out when they would be essentially playing that song and sitting by, mesmerized, until I was able to ask what it was about, get a copy of the sheet music, and then proceed to horrify the entire musical staff through the remainder of my high school years as I took every lunch hour to obsessively teach myself piano, very much to the dismay of the musical teachers around me, you know. But we had those private little areas with pianos in them, and so it was rather horrifying, but, you know, through all things you grow. Mm-hmm. And that was the start. That was the catalyst for me, the song that changed my life and set me on the course that I am right now.
So one of the reasons you're joining us is you are part of a team that has a new project coming out, a Kickstarter. We're going to get back more into your musical journey, but I do want to, let's start off, talk a little bit about this project and share a little bit about your part of it.
I have known the writer Rick Hines, who has, again, blossomed as a creator over the last decade. I've known him approximately since 2008.
Okay.
And my experiences with him were actually so impactful that they were a catalyst for me to write the first album, which was considered the Red Opera, and make this great big metal musical theater production that I have today. He was a big inspiration for doing that. And so what really led to this was him initially deciding that he wanted to take the first album that I did and take the story and reimagine it in the realm of his realm, which is the RPG and the high fantasy and all that. So in a, and then taking the orchestral incarnation of my metal soundtrack, the Red Opera orchestral album, and using that as the musical background for the campaign, harmoniously merging music and fantasy and the gaming all into this one great grand experience where we really poured all, both of our mutual passions into it. And when he had broken off and separated from the previous studio, he founded his own. And I was first in line, and we decided that we were going to do this again. I already had the album concept and everything written, and he took that and created yet again this most beautiful, unexpected world that I'm actually getting a chance to experience for the first time, because I gave him that carte blanche freedom to just take it and make it his own. Because I believe that these things are not, when you release something, it's no longer yours. And you want to genuinely encourage and nurture anybody who wants to be inspired and take that and run with it. And so now it has become its own realm, a parallel dimension in a way, where all of my characters and their names and the plot beats are exactly the same, but the set dressing is completely different because it's in a whole different realm. And it allows us both the mutual creative freedom to work off of each other and to just create this harmonious experience. And yet again, I'll be and have already written the orchestral soundtrack for it. So I'm very excited, very excited. This is going to be kind of a culmination of the last decade of us really striving towards something that we both believed in.
Yeah, the project is Black Ballad. I will include a link on in our show notes. Summarize what the story is a little bit, and then I want to go a little bit more into the creative process, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. In terms of the story summarization on my end, because again, I'm also being surprised with some of the twists and turns that he's taking in his realm, but as far as the core metal album Dia Morte story, it picks up right where the events of the Red Opera left off, in which there was a very cataclysmic event and a very Macbethian end to the characters. However, their rage, their scorn, their vengeance carries on into the afterlife.
Okay.
And with that, Majin, who is the character who, known as the Betrayer, he, in my story, through the various tracks which actually emulate the stages of grief and loss, takes the characters to the final kind of acceptance of their death, and the overarching story essentially being that you guys can let go because there's nothing left to fight for. They were so enraged they didn't even realize that they were dead, and trying to bring that through the various stages of grief and loss, because my background, as few people know, at least publicly, that I was a mortuary cosmetologist for almost a decade. And I took the experience of of being in the funeral industry and actually poured all that, plus my life experiences, into the themes of what the characters are going to go through. The characters themselves are various facets of my own kind of personality and outlooks on life, and they kind of each carry a paragon of that, from the anger, the denial, the hope for humanity, but the, also the blind pessimism. And so the various characters reflect that, and I subject them to this plot. And now that that is over, Rick has dutifully taken that and brought those same themes into his story, and I'm very excited to see where he takes it.
So how it sounds like you guys have a very strong relationship, a very a good partnership. What is, I obviously there's a lot of trust, because you're giving, you have a vision of what you're doing, you're giving it to him, he works on as it, then gives it back to you. Talk to me a little bit about that process. Do you, are, is it a true partnership? Is there a handoff, or is it a collaboration?
Outside of what I, you know, we would actually consider to be blood, Rick is as close of a brother as I have.
Okay.
Plain and simple. I unequivocally said that he is the only person I would ever have trusted to respect everything that I'm doing and give it the integrity that it needed. I am not quick to, you know, trust, and that just comes from years of, you know, dealing with the kinds of people you often do deal with in the entertainment industry. And I'm striving for a genuine honesty, because that's the only way that you're ever going to make an impact on the listener and the audience, through honesty and through love and through trust. And if I went into this, and as I believe that if you go into any sort of creative endeavor with reservations and without the measure of trust, that only the end result suffers. And you are doing the audience a disservice, because you're giving them something half-hearted, because you're not putting your all into it, because you cannot trust to put your all into it. And it all leads to half-hearted attempts, and eventually, I believe, kind of something that becomes gangrenous over time. And so you have to start off with that strong foundation, or just not do it at all.
You know, listening to you talk, Drake, it really does share, you've talked about hearing Beethoven, adjusting your life, and in American Graffiti, where that soundtrack helped tell the story. And so now then you are doing that in your career, where you are using your music, your instrumentation, to help tell a story. Am I being overly simplifying that, you know, from A to B? And I'm sure there are other steps in between.
I think simplicity is best. And I think that people have a tendency to overcomplicate it.
Yeah.
There doesn't need to be a magic or mystery behind the process.
Yeah.
The process is honest, and it's, I wanted to share my life through the satire of a story in a setting that actually resonated with me. Even the setting of the Shadelands, where it all takes place, is a reflection of those gray autumn days that I actually grew up truly loving. And I tried to, again, paint the setting as honestly as I felt it. You know, in the characters being, you know, reflections of facets of my various philosophies and outlooks on life, as I kind of flick from one to the other, from optimist to pessimist, and everything in between. Those are, again, reflected in the characters. So what I, in essence, try to do, as I had mentioned, that even in, you know, Bruce Springsteen and various rock musicians and icons, the people that genuinely are legends, share the commonality that we're trying to tell something honestly and with integrity, and it resonated. And I think that that is the reason why people end up, well, a huge contributing factor of why they are as large as they are, is because there's a common thread between country, music, metal, opera, And if we see those, it allows us the accessibility to appreciate, you know, different various musics. And I do now, jazz a little bit, although I, again, don't know many of the names. I'm not a names and faces person. I genuinely just seek out the modes and motifs that resonate with me. So I'm more fixated on the music than I think the people.
So a couple of years ago, Ken Burns did a country music documentary. And what was, I thought, fascinating is he had Marcellus, you know, the jazz performer, talking about that he said, a Texas swing band, a Western swing, like Bob Wills, he said, if you look at them with the band leader and having the different instruments take a solo and playing it, he says, then you look at a jazz quartet and them playing with solos, he says, they are cousins to each other. It is, you know, they are so similar that you would not have thought that a, you know, if you try to say a jazz band and a Western swing, you're like, no, there's no way they're related, but they actually are. And I thought your statement about this all interweaving together, this gumbo of music, is incredibly simple yet complex.
It made me smile when you said that right now, because it made me think of an interview that, funny enough, and trust me, there is a point to this, an interview with a Norwegian symphonic black metal band, which, by all rights, I'm sure most of your listeners may not be listening to. However, what in the interview, the people, the musicians, are talking about how their parents were jazz and blues pianists, and how the chords were actually very blues and very much so. Even in black metal, the chords that are used got that bluesy feel to them on many levels. And that goes to the point of really taking a step back. And I believe, like you said, looking at the roots and paying homage to it, because it had to have started somewhere. And I think to not at least give a nod to where it all comes from, it only says that, you know, in I think in an egotistical way, that, you know, you're developing something that's original. And it's okay to not be original, as long as you're honest with what you're doing.
Yeah. Couple of things. One, we had, so there is a wonderful podcast called The History of Rock and Roll in 500 Songs. And he did an episode on Stand By Me, the Benny King song. Mm-hmm. And he broke apart how many different pieces of tributes or theft. He did, like, he borrowed all this and put it together and made it something original, and in many ways a classic, right? That Stand By Me is just a one mm-hmm. of those songs that stand by forever, that are and I love that as a creative person. Almost anything can be an influence, right? Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about that as you're a storyteller as well as a musician, you know, that it, influences can come from anywhere, correct?
Yeah. I mean, the influence behind the Black Ballad is a very, and I'm just going to say this, it's a very visceral influence, and it comes from a very personal place, and I'm okay talking about it, but sure. You know, I would say to, you know, the listeners that there is going to be a lot of morbidity behind it. And again, we're talking about the Black Ballad, which I named being a funerary tone, and all of the songs having a funerary overtone. In the actual album itself, I do have a more jazzy and bluesy song. I do actually have a classical, and I bring all those as I did with the Red Opera, where I had a doom metal song, I had a Viking metal song, but using the overarching of symphonic. I digress. So getting into where the Black Ballad all comes from, a lot of it, when talking about the music was inspirational in me creating a diverse plethora of different tracks in which I tap into that and use blues chords or use classical or, you know, bring metal into it. As far as the where the story came from, started with childhood, and that in of itself was because of the fact that I had been born late, or at least mid late, into my family's kind of generation. And so before the age of 12, I went to approximately like 9 funerals, all at the same funeral home. And the reason I say that is because I grew up and eventually went and felt a calling to go work in said funeral home. And that's where my career started. The very next day, my stepfather passed away. And he, for all intents and purposes, was, I guess what you would say, morbidly jokingly, my first customer. Mm-hmm. I also lived at the funeral home because I was on call. They had condominiums that were underneath it. So I worked, lived, and experienced death on a constant basis, and wrote the majority of the Black Ballad while I was still working there. I couldn't really take the scheduling anymore, but the themes of and the knowledge and the wisdom that I got from all of that experience, and also the fact that almost all of my family has already actually passed away from various cancers and ailments, all of that was bled into the album, and I am essentially telling and retelling the entire experience, just like with the Red Opera was its own experience. I'm retelling that, and also in a way going and wanting to bring in those steps of grief and loss is just a way to kind of construct it as well and give an overarching theme to it all. So between all that and then finalizing with the acceptance, it allows me in a way, I think, to kind of close the chapter on this aspect of my life, which has been running for the last decade almost. And with that, it'll also allow me to give, like we were talking about, an aspect of a musical legacy, something to be able to be related to. And just like myself with the various songs, you know, give clarity to some mixed up kid or somebody else out there that might be going through the same thing.
You know, the cliche, write what you know, but that is a, thank you for sharing, by the way.
Of course. I
understand that Bruce talked about once that on his Storytellers episode for VH1, he was telling about a song, and he said something along the lines of, was I consciously thinking of that when I wrote it? Maybe. Was I plotting this out? Maybe. Was I feeling it? Absolutely. And I think that really does have that, right, where you can share that. And I think one of the things that I love about music so much is the ability to heal and to bring together, that and this shared experience is just something pretty special. And I think that's wonderful how you've taken that and kind of moved it through to tell your stories and to deal in your own way with your life experiences, your grief.
I think more so I'm hoping that instead of, and I do want to emphasize, I really strive to be devoid of having anything be made about me. Ironically, even though I'm writing it, you know, satirically about myself, but that is not the point. I'm far from the only individual that ever went through this. And it's more, if I were to give any message through the lyrics and through the songs and the construction of it all, it is to bring that acceptance, I think, to the listener that, you know, number one, it's okay. You know, it's okay to let go and to live your life and to accept things, and to come to those realities, which I actually felt was very liberating to me when I did kind of accept my own mortality. And actually, really, it lit a fire under me to do even more. Because when you realize the preciousness and the finite of life and the fragility of it. So those are some of the things I hope to share. And again, I feel that it's wonderful that I get to take part in something that transcends, again, genres, where these stories have been retold, much like Rick, he himself is telling this story in a different area. This story's probably in some ways been told, you know, countless times through operas and through classical music. And I see myself as someone who is not the originator of it, but just grateful to be a part of it.
Yeah. One of my favorite stories is, it was in Isaac Asimov's autobiography. He talked about, he was at a lecture and he was talking about a story he had written. And someone in the audience raised their hand.
Yeah. Said,
"Dr. Asimov, that's not what the story is about." And you know, Isaac being Isaac Asimov, said, "What do you mean? I wrote the story. I of course know what the story's about." And the reader said, "Just because you wrote it, what makes you think you know what it's about?"
I like that.
And Isaac in his autobiography said it struck him that the guy was right. And he says, "Never again do I," he says, "I know what I wanted to say when I wrote it, but that doesn't mean that's what it says to my reader." And I think of that on music, as an artist and as a composer, you put down what your feelings and your thoughts and what you're wanting to portray, but it's a partnership with your listener, and your listeners may get something totally else out of it, which is just as valid, which is just as meaningful as theirs. Correct.
I am very glad you said that last part, just as valid, just as meaningful. That is the exact sentiment that I take with what Rick is currently doing and what, you know, they are doing, because it is just as valid and just as meaningful. There is, you know, I think we'd even said the old adage of, once you release something, it's the death of the artist, is it's no longer yours. And I believe that. I think that there's a two prong to creating a piece of art, or just creating in general, specifically, you know, art, music, and the creative. You have to first create something of such exceptional quality that it is palatable and appetizing, at least to your intended audience. The second is that it has to be effectively communicated. One of the criticisms that I got, which was an unfortunate byproduct, was the first album started out as this 400-page unreleased novel that I then took, turned into lyrics, added the music, etc. But it left a lot on the cutting room floor. I had people that enjoyed it but did not fully understand it. And that, I feel, is a failure on my part that I hope to rectify, you know, always moving forward. So I think that those two are equally important. Just the same as you could think of something creative or poetic, but you need the necessary skill to implement it and to communicate it. And I think that those are two things that are harmonious. And then everything else after that is just an overlay of musical theater or movies or literature or anything.
So what's next for you? What do you want to do creatively next?
Well, I have aspirations, but I don't ever make it as such an ambitious point as to see beyond the current. Okay. And to give my full attention to that. In my lifetime, I've worked and been privileged to work with a lot of very major name musicians through being a graphic designer. Some of them were struggling, you know, in a lot of different ways. It was always my 20-year goal to be a sort of production house and powerhouse and entity that would be able to hire out musicians to do shows across the world and give a dignified employment and do something genuinely good for artists. With this project, I'm starting to be able to manifest that along with Rick. We were able to hire voice actors. We were able to pay the artists and give them work and honest wages. And I was able to help a couple of musician friends out as well. And they were people, funny enough, one being the composer for Symphony X, Michael Romeo, mm-hmm. where I grew up listening to his music, and now I'm privileged to be able to work with him to work on the orchestral aspect of this music. That alone right there is something worth, I think, devoting the rest of my life for. And outside of that, the details are negligible. I have that one goal. I want to be able to inspire the listener and support the artist. And if I could do that with the meager years that I have left and do some sort of genuine good, either through music or, you know, artistic philanthropic pursuits, then I will consider myself a satisfied man.
Great answer. Very nice. Yeah, the project is Black Ballad. It's on Backer Kit. I will include the link in the show notes. So far, it's off to a good start, it looks, correct?
Yeah, I believe as of a day or so ago, we just broke 100,000, and it's still trending upwards, and I'm deeply, deeply grateful to those who believed in it. I would also like to say, even in just partial closing, that I still see myself as that dumb kid with a Casio keyboard in a dream who is very much into fantasy, and it's just been an incredible experience that I've been able to be even afforded now through the people that believed in me, mm-hmm. as well as the people that are currently supporting it. And they're good people that are working on this, and they're all very passionate, and I couldn't be prouder to be a part of it.
That is awesome. I really appreciate it. Is there anything I should have asked you that I haven't?
Well, maybe you had talked about this in a previous, but I would actually be interested to see what song changed your life.
So there's a couple. I grew up, I was born in 59. I graduated high school in 77. So I was a child of AM radio. Drake, you know, had it on my mm-hmm. little talk radio next to the bed, American Top 40, you know, Casey Kasem, and, mm-hmm. You know, and right after I graduated, I was a kid. I loved Kiss. I loved, you know, all the AM radio and all the, you know, whether it's, you know, Foghat or Kiss. I went through a phase where I adored Kiss. But I went and bought at a Montgomery Ward's, of all things, a 8-track of Endless Summer, which was a collection of Beach Boy songs. And hearing the Beach Boys for the first time, I had never heard anything like it. I, 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 I just had never heard anything so beautiful and so complex. And so I became obsessed with Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, and they were my first musical obsession. And then was a casual fan of Bruce Springsteen, you know, like everyone else in the world, bought Born in the USA and you know, Tunnel of Love, and kind of drifted apart. And then when the Rising happened, when 9/11, and they had that fundraiser, which opened with him singing My City of Ruins, and I heard him perform live the first time in 2002. You know, that you know, went me from being a casual fan to this passionate fan. I have a friend who does Music Talks is the name of his podcast. His name is Terry Smith. And what he does is he has his guest pick a song from every decade they've been alive. So like, I was born in 59. So when I was on there, I had to get a song for the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and the aughts. And the only thing is, it had to be a song that came out in the 60s, right? And that was a really fun kind of picking those songs. So I think those Beach Boys songs changed me musically. And then hearing that City of Ruins went from being this casual fan to, oh my goodness, maybe this guy, Bruce Springsteen, is more than what I thought he was. So that would be my two answers.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I always ask everyone the Mary question. And if you are listening to this because you're already supporting Black Ballad, or because you're a fan of Drake's different creative endeavor, the Mary question is this. Jay Armstrong, who is an honors English teacher in the Philadelphia area, recently retired, he would take the song Thunder Road by Bruce Springsteen and break apart as a poem. His students would read all the lyrics. They would discuss the themes that Bruce is exploring. They would compare it to Robert Frost, The Road Not Taken, among other American poetry. And then at the end of the 2 days, Jay would ask his class, does Mary get in the car? So Drake, that is your question. Does Mary get in the car at the end of Thunder Road?
Put me on the spot, aren't you?
It's okay if you need to. Edit this out.
It's good to think about it, because there's a lot that it would say about her, depending on her position. And the reason why I find it even difficult to say whether or not she got in the car was because, first, we would have to examine the type of person she is and the type of person he is, and ask ourselves what we would honestly do. And I think, in a funny way, I think our answer might just be very telling of the kind of individual that we are. I think the ambiguity of it, to be perfectly honest, was the intention. Obviously, because we're talking about it right now, I'm going to probably go with no. Only because I cannot presume on somebody's personality and who they are as an individual. And I'm going to go with the chivalrous self-respect.
By the way, the answer I have had two or three people say, and in fact, Brian Kupperman, one of the co-creators of Billions, said, we don't know, and that's the purpose of the song.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, that is a legitimate answer to say, no, we aren't supposed to know. It's kind of like The Lady and the Tiger, you know, that short story. Yeah. 60% say yes. About 40% of my audience say no. There's various different reasons. You know, some people go no because He called her ugly. He says, hey, you ain't a beauty. You ain't all right. Why would she go in the car with him? Others say, absolutely, she gets in the car because, you know, he's putting his heart out there. And she goes. And one of the things Jay talks about with his students is that making a decision is scary. Choosing something is scary. Mm-hmm. And she has to get off that porch, you know, from your front porch to my front seat. She has to make that decision. And sometimes, and he thinks she doesn't. He says he thinks she's too afraid to do it. I've had other people that say she said no, but then later when he came back and become mature, she said yes. One of my favorites is she says yes till they get to the gas station where he stops to get cigarettes. And she goes, what am I doing? You know? So thank you. That was a great answer, Drake. I end every podcast with it because I do think it's an interesting question. And I do think that even if you're not a Springsteen fan, you know, and I always try to put that in the agenda, listen to the song, read the lyrics, and be ready. Mm-hmm. It makes for a fun way to end the podcast.
Absolutely. Because I think it touches very much on something that I am greatly into, and that would be philosophy and philosophers. There was one by a lecture by Alan Watts, and I'll keep this brief, in which he kind of said that there is, in a lot of ways, no perfect answer. All you could do is spend all the time between now and the moment of truth, you know, gathering up as much information as possible, and then in a moment you make a snap decision. And he was talking about the ridiculousness of it all, you know, how you consider, snap decision, and how you can never, in a way, truly take in all of the information to make the most complete and honest answer. So it kind of touched on that. And yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you sharing the question.
One of the things that was, you know, you talk about life changing. I was talking to a mentor, and I was debating on taking a job or staying where I'm at. And, you know, I was going all of this. And Vic said, you're treating this, Jesse, like there's a correct answer. There is just an answer. You're either going to say yes to this, and, you know, you will go and you will meet new friends. You will build new relationships. You will, you know, work on this career. It may work out. It may not work out. You're going to say no. You're going to stay where you are. You're going to keep working with the people you work with. And it may work out. It may not work out. He said, you're thinking of this as, and he did not use this, and I did this choose your own path, like a video game, right? Like, oh, right. If I do this, I'm going to win the prize. And that's not what life is. Life is you make your decision and you move forward, and you really don't know what is right, what is wrong. There's just, you made the decision you think that was best at the time, and then see what happens.
Absolutely. I think that's a very good way to summarize it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my friend Rob Southgate said that I would love visiting with you, and he did not oversell. I had so much fun. I feel like I could have you on again, and we could pick a couple of songs and break them apart for philosophy, and I would have a blast. We didn't even get into, you know, I was doing a podcast before, and you ended up, you know, because it's Zoom, you got in a little bit early, which, by the way, thank you. And we talked about the Tyler May and Co, the guy who does Cocaine and Rhinestones podcast. He did a really good discussion about, like, people keep saying, well, that's not real country music. And he said, but country music continues to evolve, and every 10 years it changes. Like, now then people are like, oh, it's bro country. Yeah, that's not really good. And he says, you know, it's because pop country music is influenced by pop music, and pop music is influenced by country music. And you know, and now then hip hop has influenced pop and all these different musics. And you have a sense of nostalgia for what you listen to during your formative years, and you decide that's the true kind of music versus being embraced by the new ones.
If I may, I think that the best way to really think about it is simple. Again, like most things, when you talk about true music, that is to say, that's not country. That's just not my country. It's still country. It has the character and the traits of it. It doesn't have to be yours. You have yours. Let everybody else have theirs. And as long as they're not encroaching, you know, on what you're doing, live and let live. Because it all stems back to, okay, well then which one's more valid? Whose personal life experiences are more valid? Who is changed by what genre? And are you going to punish a further generation for being accidentally influenced by something 20 years down the road from what you had? And who's to say that your influences weren't then scoffed at by people of previous generations? So I just think that the whole thing needs to come down to self and a more live and let live when it comes to really anything. You know, it doesn't have to be yours, it just is.
And I would think that at times, and I don't know if this, I think this is a byproduct of social media, and I'm not
society,
it's society, but I know that's vague, but you know, it's not enough for me to like something. I have to attack you if you don't like what I like. Versus, you know, like, how dare you not like what I like? Versus, you know, and I know it's a cliche, but like I had there was a writer once says, if you like this sort of thing, you're gonna like this thing. You know, I can see a show, a movie, a TV show, a song, and go, that's not my thing, but I can recognize the greatness in it, right? And good for you, mm-hmm. love it, yeah.
Thank you for that. And it's been a pleasure just the same. I find it actually very wonderful that two individuals of very, I wouldn't even say opposed, just contrasting genres and backgrounds are able to find this common ground. And I feel that if people talked more in this manner with this measure of respect, people they'd be surprised what they might actually get into. By the way, one of my previous favorites, Only You by the Platters.
Oh, I love that song.
Mm-hmm. Great. See? Yes,
that was one of my mom's 45s. When I got my mom's 45s, I remember playing that and loving that song. Now you just smile horribly. Big old things. Drake, thank you so much. Listeners, go check out the campaign. Read about it. If this is something that interests you, this appears wonderful. And I can't wait to hear more. You are welcome anytime. Anytime you have something
to promote,
anytime you want to visit, reach out. We will do this again. If someone wants to reach you, what's the best way?
Simply go to diamorte.com, D-I-A-M-O-R-T-E. I am the graphic designer and the web builder behind that. And I've provided all the links that will take you anywhere you want to go. The link tree is there. So everything will be easily accessible.
Well, thank you, kind sir. I will include that in the notes. Thank you. This was such a great time. Listeners, please go check this out. In the meantime, let's try to be kind to each other. Let's be safe, and we will talk to you soon. Goodbye.
Have a good evening.
There we go. Another episode. I'm about to go through a couple of things where you can reach me and give me feedback. So if you want to skip this, I understand, but I do hope you check it out every once in a while. I'm available on Twitter at Jesse Jackson DFW. The show is available at setlustingbruce. You can send me an email, setlustingbruce@gmail.com. You can send me a voicemail at 469-249-2442. I am currently doing a few other podcasts, Perfectly Good Podcast, John Hiatt from A to Z, where Sylvan Groth and I discuss every John Hiatt song in alphabetical order. My Babylon 5 podcast is Last Best Hope for Conversation, where Lou, Karen, and I discuss every episode of Babylon 5 in chronological order. I still am doing Next Stop Everywhere, the Doctor Who podcast with my brother in time, Charles Skaggs. And then finally, How Many Podcasts, the only podcast on the internet that counts, where my buddies and I discuss pop culture. You can go to our Patreon page and support the podcast for as little as a dollar a month. You can go to our Facebook page, like, and please, please go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast and leave a 5-star rating and review for all of the podcasts that I'm doing. It's okay if you don't listen to them, but if you subscribe and rate, it really will make my day better. Thank you, and I will talk to you soon.
You just heard the fun-talking, hard-rocking, music-loving, album-ranking, fan-thinking, joy-spreading, lyric-reading, story-sharing podcast that is the one, the only, Bed Listing Bruce. The theme for Set Listing Bruce was written by David Rosen, used by permission.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.